We're at the book of 1 Peter. Did we begin them? Is this the fourth week I've been up here? Has it been three? I can't remember. I think it's four. Anyway, time's going fast. We're in the book of 1 Peter. We're looking through verses 13 through 17. And in verses 13 through 17, Peter will lay out four principles how we're to walk in holiness and what these four principles will mean in our lives. Last week, as we concluded the session, we found out that holiness or walking in holiness means that we must have a focused mind. Where Peter says we must be sober in spirit, or we're to gird our minds for action. Today, we'll pick up with the second one of these qualities. And that is this: walking in holiness results in a well-defined goal. Look at verse 13, part B. Therefore, gird your minds for actions. Keep sober in spirit. That was last week. Now he says, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He mentions here the revelation of Jesus Christ. My understanding of the term revelation and all that means the second coming, when Christ comes back and he'll come back to claim his own. So that's what we're to have our minds focused on. Now, you guys may remember back here several years back in the Olympics that were held in Athens, Greece, there was an American sharpshooter by the name of Matt Emmons. He was one shot away from winning a gold medal. He was leading the competition, hands up. All he had to do was just roughly hit anywhere near the target, and he would be assured of a gold medal. And he had competed and trained for years for this opportunity. When it came time for him to shoot, he took aim and shot. The target never registered a hit. Come to find out, he was standing in lane three, and he shot the target in lane two, which was an automatic disqualification. He ended up placing eighth in competition out of the medals, all because he made a serious flaw. He was focusing on the wrong target. And Peter here is telling these people he's addressing that our focus needs to be on the second coming of Christ. Okay, now, I realize today we have to work, we have to make a livelihood, we have to have a family, you know, we got all types of things pulling at us. But ultimately, our ultimate goal and our ultimate focus should be on Christ and his kingdom. And ultimately, we know he's coming back to earth for his own. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, we hear a lot today about the second coming of Christ. You know, a matter of fact, you guys remember just this last week, the eclipse. Well, supposedly in 2024, we have another eclipse coming. And I was reading this last week. People are already predicting this next eclipse will be the end of the world and the second coming of Christ. You may remember the 2000K, when the clocks were, when we hit 2000, everybody was worried about the computers and all, people thinking it would be the end of the world. Also, remember 2012 was the end of the Mayan calendar. People were doing what? Predicting the end of the world. From the time Christ left the earth, even until now, people are still trying to predict when he will come back. Bible just says he'll be back. It doesn't say the exact time. We're to be prepared for him. Now, speaking about the second coming of Christ, this makes me think of a story told about a preacher. And he preached on the second coming of Christ. And when he got through, he says, I want everybody here to raise your hand that wants to go to heaven. Everybody raised their hand. And down toward the front of the assembly, there was a guy sitting there on his hands just kind of rocking back and forth. The preacher looked at him and he says, don't you want to go to heaven? And the old boy says, yeah, but he says, you're not taking up a load right now, are you? But see, at some future date, we all want to go to heaven, don't we? But not right now. We got too many things we want to do. I think it's Kenny Chesney. He has out a song. Says everybody want to go to heaven, but what? Nobody want to die. Now, short of the Lord coming back, the only way we can get to heaven is by dying. Everybody wants to go, but yet we don't want to die. That's kind of the way it goes. Now, I'd like to point out some examples of people trying to predict the end of the world. Years ago in the 18th century, there was a religious leader by the name of William Miller. He began what later became known as the Seventh-day Adventist Church. He was notorious for predicting the end of the world. He predicted on between March 21st, 1842 and March 21st, 1843, that the world would come to an end between those years, for a year there. It never happened. He went back and then predicted that the end of the world would come between October 20 and October 22nd, 1844. October the 20th, the 21st, 23rd, and 24th came. Christ didn't come back to earth. 5 years later, he died. And his followers probably wrote the smartest and the most wise thing about him or about that second coming of Christ when on their tomb, they wrote the following words, quote, "At the appointed time, the end shall be." Christ has a time when he's coming back. We don't know when it is, but when he comes back, we're to be prepared for it. Now, in the 1980s, you may remember, a lot of people predicted the end of the world in the 1980s. It was a book by Hal Lindsey called The Late Great Planet Earth. He predicted between the late 1980s, that the world would come to an end. It never happened. You've probably heard of a top NASA mathematician named Edgar Weisenhut. In the 1980s, he was one of the top NASA mathematicians. He predicted that the rapture would take place in 1988. And he even wrote a book entitled 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Take Place in 1988. He was even bold enough to go on to say that if the rapture didn't take place in 1988, quote, "If I'm wrong, then the scripture is mistaken." He was wrong, but there's nothing wrong with the scriptures. You may remember the 1990s, 1994, a religious leader by the name of Harold Camping. He predicted the second coming of Christ and the end of the world numerous times. It never happened. So people have always been notorious about predicting the end of the world and when time will end. Now, I'd like to read something by C.S. Lewis that gives us an idea of the attitude we have if we're looking toward the end of time, the type of people we should be. He writes, quote, "Hope is one of the theological virtues. This means that a continual looking forward to the external world is not, as some modern people think, a form of escapism or wishful thinking, but one of the things a Christian is meant to do. It does not mean that we're to leave the present world as it is. If you read history, you will find out that the Christian who did the most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this. Aim at heaven and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you will get neither." Now, let's look over at the book of Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. Look at the book of Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. Anyone want to volunteer to read that for us? Whoever gets there first can read it.
"Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer of our perfect faith, for the joy is set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God."
Okay, we're to have our eyes focused on Jesus. And ultimately, if our eyes are focused on Jesus, we'll be focused on him coming back to the earth again. But like I say, people have always tried to predict when the end of the world would come. And we really don't know, except it's promised. Now, I think a good attitude we should have today goes along the lines of a commercial that Delta Airlines had out years ago. This commercial went the following way. "We're ready when you are." And can we say that if Christ came back today, would we be ready? Would we be ready for him to come back today? Now let's look at Acts chapter 1. Acts chapter 1, verse 10 and 11. Acts 1, verse 10 and 11. Kurt, would you read that for us, please?
"And as they were gazing intently into the sky while he was going, behold, two men in white clothing stood beside them. They also said, 'Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into the sky? This Jesus, who has been taken up from you into heaven, will come in just the same way as you have watched him go into heaven.'"
Okay, now, the second coming of Christ is the singular doctrine that makes Christianity so different from history, science, or philosophy. And here's why. What does history say? History says look back. Science says look around. Philosophy says look within. Christianity says look up, because we see Christ coming back to the earth once again. Now, you may remember Johnny Carson years ago on his TV show. One night he had Billy Graham on there, and they were talking back and forth, and there was kind of a lull in the conversation. And Johnny Carson looked at Billy Graham and said the following. He says, "You know what, Billy? I bet if Jesus ever came back to earth, I bet we'd do him in again." Billy Graham leaned over forward in his seat and said, quote, "In the Bible we read that Jesus predicted that he would return to the earth again. But the first time he came in love. The next time he will come in power, and no one will do him in." In the news media, they speak about, I forget what they call second coming events. In the news media, you know what a second coming event is? It is something like September 11th, 9/11. Shattering news. The attack on Pearl Harbor. Things like that. The assassination of JFK. Those are what they call second coming events. Now, could you think of anything that would be a bigger news story than the second coming of Christ? I mean, everything comes to an end. And imagine people in shock and dismay as they stand and look around trying to imagine what's happening. Now, as I finish up this point here about the second coming, I heard a humorous story, I think, that might drive home what I'm trying to say. I read a story about a girl, and she was asked out on a blind date, and she was really looking forward to the person who had asked her out. She was really wanting to meet him. So the day they were supposed to go out on their date, she took the day off from work. She cleaned up her house, scrubbed it, and it was spotless. In the afternoon, she went to the beauty salon, got her hair done, went and had a manicure, went home that afternoon, put on her best dress, brushed her teeth, fixed her hair, just looked immaculate. And she sat out and started waiting for this man to show up to come to her house. And she sat there and waited, and she waited, and she waited, and he never showed up. After about an hour, she figured, well, you know, I've been stood up. So she figured, he's not coming. So then she took off of her beautiful dress. She let her hair down. She put on her pajamas and sat down on the sofa and got all kind of junk food and all and started eating. Because she said, hey, the guy's not coming. So she sat there. And about 2 hours after he was supposed to show up, there was a knock on the door. And the guy came in. And when he came in, he said the following. He said, I gave you an extra 2 hours, and you're still not ready to go. Now think about this. When Christ comes back to the earth, I wonder how many people in the church he will say, I've given you 2,000 years to get prepared for this. You're still not ready to go. Could that be said of a lot of us? Next of all, Peter, he says that walking in holiness results in personal purity. Look at 1 Peter 1, verse 14 and 15. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. But like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior. Because it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Now then, Peter here stresses the fact that they're to be a holy people. What does the term holy mean?
Set apart.
Now, the temple was holy. Why was it holy? It was separate and set apart. It was like no other building. Okay, we're to be a holy or a set apart people. What does that mean?
You know, Walter, in our culture today, the word holy has a different meaning, at least to me.
Okay.
And I assume I'm half normal. Holiness today takes on a devoutness. More than just being set apart, it takes on a spiritual aspect.
Absolutely.
I think we've changed the word, maybe, maybe not. But today, it's a special, devout
Absolutely.
Word. A place to be. Yes, it's set apart, but it's in righteousness.
That's right. Set apart for the things you just mentioned. Very good point. Yes. You're right. Yep. Very good. So we're to be a separate or set apart people who are holy, pure people. Now, if we say the Sabbath is a holy day, what does that mean? It means it was set aside for a specific purpose. We as holy people, we're set aside as a holy people to be righteous and to be honorable and moral and all, like Virgil pointed out. Now, I've been told or I've read that the word holiday comes from the word holy. So what is a holiday? We use it loosely today, but it's basically a day that is set aside for something. So we're to be a holy, set aside people. Now, we live in a culture that's just absolutely saturated with immorality and everything else. Matter of fact, I read of a professor at a seminary who was teaching future preachers. And he went so far as to encourage those young men, many of them, to get two degrees. Because so many of them were going to be disqualified from ministry because of immorality. But look in the church, or look in the religious world today, how many people in the church, and preachers included, whose lives become destroyed because of immorality. Okay, so we're to be a separate and a set apart people. Now, I would like to give a little bit of a background on the history of the times that Peter wrote this, and to show you why what he said was so important. You've all heard of Clement of Alexandria. He was an early church father. He described the typical Roman lady of society the following way, quote, "Girt like Venus with a golden girdle of vice." You've all heard of Juvenal, the Roman. In his writings, he was quoted as saying, he's talking about a woman named Iberina. And in writing about her, he says the following, "Is one husband enough for Iberina? Sooner you prevail upon her to be content with one eye." He also cites the case of one woman who had 8 husbands over the course of 5 years. Okay? He cites the incredible story of Agrippina, who was the wife of the Emperor Claudius, who was so given over to vice and immorality that she actually left the palace at night and went down to the brothels, and just to feed her lust was a prostitute in the temples. That's how immoral it was at that time. Seneca described the morality of ancient Rome the following way. He says, quote, "All is full of criminality and vice. Indeed, much more of these is committed than can be remembered by force. A monstrous contest of abandoned wickedness is carried on. The lust of sin increases daily, and shame is daily more and more extinguished. Discarding respect for all that is good and sacred, lust rushes on whatever it will be. Vice no longer hides itself. It stalks forth before all eyes. So public has abandoned wickedness become, and so openly does it flame up in the minds of all, that innocence is no longer seldom, but has wholly ceased to exist." Now let's turn over to the book of 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Look at verses 3 and 4. First Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 3 and 4. Anyone want to read that for us? Any volunteers?
"All people are saying peace and safety. Destruction will come on them suddenly, as labor pains on a pregnant woman, and they will not escape."
Okay, I give you the wrong verse. I'm sorry. That's the second coming. There's one in there, I forget, in 1 Thessalonians 3 and 4, 1, that has to do with immorality. I apologize for that. Okay, now, 1 Thessalonians 5, 3 and 4. I'll give you the wrong verse. Try 4, maybe in 4. I'm sorry. Try 4, 3 and 4.
"It is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control his own body in a way that is holy and honorable."
That's it. Okay, now think about this. We're to be, now, back in the 1980s, I read a story told about a monk. And this monk had lived in a cave for years and years and years. And he was wanting to not to be conformed to the world, not be like the world. And he lived in a cave, and supposedly people would send food up to him, and he stayed years there. And he finally came out of seclusion, and he never had any contact with the world. Now, we're not to be a part of the world, but I don't believe God expects us to take it to that extreme. We're to be in the world, but where's the balance? Any thoughts?
No, not the world.
Okay. And it's tough to rub shoulders in the world today and not it, you know, not get spotted and stained by it. I mean, look at the entertainment on TV. Look at almost everything. You go to the mall, you go out to eat. Just driving out down the road, what do you see? You see people half-dressed. I mean, it's just a way of life. And it's difficult to resist that, but we're to be a holy and a people separated and apart from the world, okay? So that's the idea we have here before us. Now, a couple other thoughts on this. You remember Will and Ariel Durant speaking about morality and the type of people we have to be. Years ago, they wrote the following. They said, quote, "No man or woman, however brilliant or well-informed, can safely dismiss the wisdom of lessons learned in the laboratory of history. A youth boiling with hormones will wonder why he should not give full freedom to his sexual desires. But if he is unchecked by custom, morals, or laws, he may ruin his life before he understands that sex is a river of fire that must be banked and cooled by 100 restraints if it is not to consume in chaos both the individual and the group." So as a culture and as a society, you know, go back and look at Rome and look at Greece. You will find out when they first came into existence and all, there was an unbelievable amount of focus put on strong morals, family living, and all that. Trace both cultures through for their fall. And notice how all that disappeared, and they just almost accepted anything morally. And what's surprising to me is to look at our own country within a couple hundred years and find out the morality and the morals that we had when our founding fathers wrote the Constitution and formed the country and all that, and look how we have digressed. In just the last few years, like since 2000, it is shocking to me how it just seems like the wheels are coming off faster and faster. And ultimately, there'll be a price to be paid for that, ultimately. Of course, the choice is, we can look at history and learn from history, or we can repeat history, and so many times we end up repeating it. Now, let's look at 1 John chapter 2, verse 15 through 17. Mark that in your Bibles. Now, I think if when it starts speaking about the loosening of morals and all in our country and us becoming just almost like, you know, like Europe and like Rome and so forth, I'm reminded of somebody who probably did more to start that than anyone else was a man by the name of Hugh Hefner. Remember him? Everybody knows him. But anyway, way years ago when he first started Playboy magazine, he was quoted as saying, "Sex is a normal function of the body. It is a desire that man shares with the animals, just like sleeping or eating. Therefore, it is not wrong to satisfy these normal desires." These desires are normal, but God gives us channels that we're to try, channels that we're to satisfy those desires in. And sad to say today, most people in the world today do not take that seriously. Who's got 1 John chapter 2? We'll read verses 15 through 17 for us. Okay, Virgil.
"Do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lust. But the one who does the will of God abides forever."
Okay, now, I've described Rome, the conditions of Rome and all. In America today, what do you think would be the modern day equivalent of Rome, moral wise?
Las Vegas.
You know, where else?
Hollywood.
I call it, good, I call it Hollywood. What else?
New York,
how about New Orleans?
Yeah.
Now, I went to Las Vegas about 1996, and I hadn't I haven't been back. But I went right out of high school, like 1973 or 4. And I went in the 1990s, 96 or so. And if you guys remember back then, I believe that when I was there, I noticed that it's known as adult playground. And anyway, they were trying to make it more family friendly. And they were starting to try to get things in Las Vegas that would attract more family-oriented people, would bring their kids and all. And I saw some results of that when I was there. But believe it or not, that didn't last very long. Self-indulgence and pleasure that leads to immorality brings Las Vegas to mind. In 1990s, Las Vegas tried to become more of a vacation destination for families and invested in entertainment that was geared more to families and not so much for adults. Unfortunately, that was short-lived. Listen to this. The February 15th, 2002 edition of USA Today had a front-page article headline, quote, "Skin and Sin Are In Again on the Las Vegas Strip." It says the bosom is now the bottom line. The article went on to state, quote, "Visitors come here for one thing, to party. It is estimated that on a typical Saturday night, there are now 1,000 girls stripping at the major clubs." So we see how our culture has basically just kind of followed after the societies before us. And it's difficult once a country starts declining, or country starts declining, it's difficult sometimes to turn the tide. How is the best way for us to control our natural desires? How do you control them? I remember last week what we studied last when the class ended, the mind. It all begins in the mind. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is talking about adultery. What does he say? It begins as he thinks. Proverbs says, for as he thinks within himself, so is he. So if we're going to control ourselves, we have to control our thoughts and control our minds. Now, you've probably heard, now, and I've noticed, regardless, and we've all got our sins. And in our sins, everyone's got a besetting sin. And whatever that sin is, what do we try to do? We try to get just as close to the edge as we can without going over the cliff. If it's drinking, you know, you don't want to go park within a block of a bar. If it's certain bookstores and things you don't need to be around, you certainly don't need to be parking out in front of one of them. But what we try to do is we say, well, we just get as close to it and just take maybe a peek or something. And that's our downfall. Matter of fact, there was a transportation company here a few years ago, and they were looking for a truck driver that was going to haul TNT over mountain passes. And they put an article in the paper that read the following way. Wanted, conscientious and experienced truck driver to transport TNT across narrow mountain roads. Pay is very good. And potential employers started setting up interviews and all, and they started interviewing people for this job. The first guy came in who was interviewed was asked how close could he drive to the edge of a cliff in a semi with TNT on it. How close can you drive without going over the edge? The first guy interviewed says, oh, I've had years of experience at that. I can get as close as a front foot from the edge. The second applicant said, I can hang the outside edge of my tire over the edge and still stay on the road. The third applicant said, I respect that load and the danger. I would never get close enough to find out. Out of those three applicants, who do you think got the job? The last one. But get the point? We need to avoid sin at all costs. Now let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Verses 12 and 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12 and 13. Anyone? Okay, so what does God say? He says that there's no temptation set before us that what? Now, I know that there's a lot of them I've given in to. What's the problem? What's the problem? Now, do you guys remember, they still got them, I'm sure. If you get out on county roads and all, and you go across bridges, on those bridges, there'll usually be a sign. What does that sign say?
Low limit.
What does that mean?
It means you don't have to look below the limit.
If it says 10,000 pounds or 25,000 pounds, if you're 25,000 pounds or under, you can go right through there, no worries. In essence, God is saying, hey, I'm going to put a limit to how much temptation you can stand. You can make it. But the problem is us. It's not him. Okay? He puts a limit on what we can endure. Okay? And he won't allow us to be tempted beyond what we're able. We give in to it. Now, next point. Walking in holiness results in reverence. Verse 17. Notice what Peter says here. And if you address Father as the one who impartially judges according to each man's work, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay upon earth. Okay, conduct ourselves in fear during our stay upon earth. The Greek word here translated fear is phobos. In verse 17, it means reverence or respect. William Barclay says, reverence is the attitude of the man who is always aware that he's in the presence of God. So we should live our lives aware that we're in the presence of God and that he's watching what we're doing. Now, we live in a culture today where God is not taken seriously. We hear all types of jokes and all made about him. Matter of fact, one worldly actress refers to God as the man upstairs. You've heard that many times. One famous baseball player refers to God as the great Yankee in the sky. The Old Testament Jew I've read is they were writing, the scribes, when they were writing, when they would come to God's name, many times they would go through a complete ritual and purification, wash, take a bath, change their clothes before they would even write the name. Now today, when we mention God's name or even think of God, do we have the same type of reverence that they had in the Old Testament and the Jews had for God, okay? Today, we throw God's name around loosely. Now, let's turn to Exodus chapter 20, verse 7. Exodus chapter 20, verse 7. Joel, would you read that for me? I've read your mind.
You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name.
What does it mean to misuse the name of the Lord?
Unrighteousness.
Okay, what else? I think it means a lot of things, to use it in vain, to swear. It also means just to throw it out loosely. And you know, I read, there's a guy named Gary North, and he is quoted in a book I have on the Ten Commandments. And he presents this in a way that, I mean, really, I think describes it very well. He writes the following. He says, quote, one way for a modern American to begin to understand this, speaking about this commandment, is to treat God's name as a trademarked property. In order to gain widespread distribution for his copyrighted repair manual, the Bible, and also to capture greater market share for his authorized franchise, the church, God has graciously licensed the use of his name to anyone who will use it according to his written instructions. It needs to be understood, however, that God's name has not been released into the public domain. God retains legal control over his name and threatens serious penalties against the unauthorized misuse of this supremely valuable property. All trademark violations will be prosecuted to the full limits of the law. The prosecuting judge and enforcer is God. Thought that was neat, good. But think about that. Something that is trademarked, you just can't take it and use it at will. God's name should be held in reverence and should be held in awe. The question becomes today, we don't hold God in very high esteem or very high respect. One of my favorite actors of all time was John Wayne. There'll never be another John Wayne. And the first walk-in theater I ever went to was a John Wayne movie called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But I loved John Wayne his whole life, and he really wasn't that good of an actor. But He was stereotyped to play a cowboy, and that he was good at that. But supposedly years ago when he first got started, he played in a rendition of the crucifixion. He played the part of the centurion who was standing there, and his line was to say, truly, this was the Son of God. When Jesus died on the cross, he played the part of the centurion years ago. And anyway, when his line came up, he said, truly, this was the Son of God. And the director says, stop, stop, cut. And he looked at John Wayne and says, when you say that, you need to say that with awe. So the director says, okay, cameras roll. And everybody went through their parts. And when it came to John Wayne's turn, he says, ah, this was truly the Son of God. Get the point? I mean, today, when it comes to us really being in awe and using God's name, we throw it around pretty loosely, don't we? And we should have a high reverence for that name. Now, let's go to Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. A.W. Tozer, in his book called The Knowledge of God, writes the following. He says, in olden days, men of faith were said to walk in the fear of God. However intimate their communion with God, however bold their prayers at the base of their religious life, was the conception of God as awesome and dreadful. This idea of God's transcendent runs through the whole Bible and gives color and tone to the character of saints. Now let's read Matthew 10, verse 28. Can you volunteer to read that? Matthew 10, verse 28.
And be not afraid of them that kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body.
Okay, think about that. God has the power to destroy soul and body in hell. Knowing that, I think we should hold him in very high regard. But yet today, when it comes to about honoring God and his power to be judge and all, how many people take him seriously? Here's an example of people that didn't. The April 17th, 1994 edition of the Dallas Morning News reported on the funeral of one of the founding members of the Bandidos motorcycle gang. The guy's name was Grandpa Bob Shills. He died of cancer at 78 years of age. When I lived in El Paso, there was a chapter of the Bandidos there, and they were bad apples, let me tell you. This is a rough motorcycle gang. Anyway, one of the founding members, Bob Shills, died. In this article, in this newspaper, went there and they interviewed some of the people, and some of these old bikers were standing around and they were talking about some of the things they did in their prime, you know, smuggling drugs, gang fights, stuff like that, on and on it went. And several of them in this article was quoted as saying, one of them was an old gray-haired biker. He says, quote, give them hell. The devil is now in the unemployment line. Lamont, another heavily tattooed gang member, responded by saying, quote, where he's gone, that's where he's gone, and that's where we're all going someday. He's just waiting on us. I don't want no preachers ranting and raving over me. Besides, I'm down below drinking whiskey and on the devil. Think about that. God has the power to commit our souls to hell. And as a result of that, we should hold him in awe and admiration, that yet many of us, what do we do? We make a joke out of it and all, and don't give him the place that he needs. Let's turn to Hebrews 10, verse 31. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 31.
It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God.
Okay, now, I'm going to read this. Turn over to Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20, verse 10. And Moses and Aaron, this is the account of Moses striking the rock because he's mad at the children of Israel and he strikes the rock. Notice Numbers 20, verse 10. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock and said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Most theologians I've studied or read seem to think this account here is the reason that Moses wasn't allowed to enter the promised land. Looking at that verse, Where was Moses' mistake? What did he do wrong? He was to strike the rock, and what was going to happen? What does he say? What was he doing?
Well, he didn't give God
credit. Didn't give God the credit. Now, that's pretty insignificant for us to think about that today. But yet, it was a serious thing for Moses.
He got mad.
Yep. But think about that. He didn't give God his proper pleasure, his proper respect. Yes?
Did he not give God credit? Or
huh?
Did he not give God the credit, or did he overly exalt his position?
I think he over exalted his position. That's a better way of saying it. Good point. Now, as you go into the New Testament, there's the account of King Herod, and he is on a rostrum, and the people keep screaming out, crying out, the voice of God and not of man, and what happens to him? He puts himself in the place of God, and what happens? He is struck down and eaten with worms to call himself God. Now, notice in the world today, how many gods are there? There's only one true God. Yet look at all the hodgepodge of other ones and all the people are following. God takes that seriously. Our time is up. Does anybody have any comments before we close or anything? Over here.
Let me read Numbers 20, verse 6.
Sure.
And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, take the rod and gather thou the assembly together, thou and Aaron, thy brother, and speak ye unto the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth his water. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, his mistake was he struck the rock. He didn't speak to it.
Okay.
He did with the rock.
Granted. Yeah, he did. He hit it.
He is obeying.
Yeah.
That falls in the same category as God telling us through saying and making melody in our hearts. That's why I do not believe we can have instrumental music. He didn't tell us not to. He told us what to do.
Okay. Our time is up.
Everybody don't have to agree with that.
Appreciate the comments. We'll pick up next week. Thank you.
retirement home for you.
Was it on?
No, it's not on up there.
It's not? Okay.